This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on today's episode, I'm chatting with Alton Fitzgerald White. Alton Fitzgerald White is the only Black actor who has played in a lead role in 5 hit shows on Broadway: John and Miss Saigon, Ken and Smokey Joe's Cafe, Cole House Walker Jr. in Ragtime the Musical, Mr. in the Color Purple, and King Mufasa in The Lion King. I first met White last year when he did a master class at Longleaf School of the Arts in Raleigh. It was my first live interview for Broadway World, and after spending an afternoon chatting with him, I became an instant fan. I think the thing that impressed me the most in that interview was the fact that White never lost sight of his humble beginnings growing up in the Cincinnati Projects. It was there, watching variety shows on television, that he began to dream, and that's where our conversation begins.
It started by watching TV, watching things like The Sonny and Cher Hour, The Ed Sullivan Show. Huge for me was The Flip Wilson Show, you know, the first successful variety show hosted by an African-American man. That was huge for me to have all these fantasies about someday being in show business and seeing somebody on TV who looked like me doing it. I was incredibly shy as a kid, so I never really thought I would ever find the courage to sing or perform in front of anybody, but seeing it on television, having that example, was huge for me. And even though I was afraid, I still had that to look up to. It's like, it is possible. It is possible. And then realizing that I was given this desire for a reason, and that there was a choice involved. I could either take those steps, those courageous steps, to pursue it and learn to let it flow through me, or not. But again, seeing it on TV, seeing all my favorite groups, you know, the Jackson 5, all the Motown artists, and other artists as well, you know, John Denver, Billy Joel, Elton John, I mean, all my favorite performers who moved me. Helen Reddy, you know, those are the folks who are like, wow, they're doing it and it is possible. So that's kind of where it started for me, using my imagination and having variety shows to look to as inspiration.
When we spoke before, you told me a really lovely story. I know there are so many women and teachers in your life who have set you on your path, and you talked about one woman in church who heard you sing. Can you tell me that story again?
Well, teachers are my heroes. I mean, really. I respect actors and creative people because we do have to chart our own path. But right up there, in terms of respect, my respect are parents and teachers. And I had a teacher who was very patient with me, who saw things in me that I felt but was afraid to express. There was a solo available when I was in junior high in choir. And around the same time it was happening at my church, so I had two teachers, the musical director at my church and Mrs. Turner in junior high school. In church, I had to do a solo because one of the requirements of being in the choir was to, at some point, do a solo. And I was auditioning for a solo in junior high. And both these teachers were so patient with me, you know, and spent time with me and had compassion for my being afraid. And, you know, would let me wait until everybody left and would work with me to me going from like a, you know, whispering the song to finally singing louder, to feeling comfortable enough with them to like sing with my full voice, and them encouraging me, you can do this in front of the class. You can do this in front of the other choir members. You can do this. It is possible. You can do it. And then when those times came, when I sang in church for the first time and looked up at the ceiling because I didn't know where else to look because I was so frightened, you know, I got through it. And the same thing at school. And having that validation and knowing that somebody believed in me even more than I believed in myself was tremendous for me. And having the patience to really nurture me. And that's what I needed. I needed that nurturing. Because singing was my secret up to that point. I didn't know that I could sing, but I loved the sensation of singing. But never in a million years thought I would ever sing in front of anybody. And these teachers are like, you can do this.
Shout out to the teachers.
Shout out to teachers forever. You know, I do a lot of public speaking now, which has become probably my new number one passion. And I always give a shout out to teachers. Always, always, always.
Well, and I feel like you've become a teacher in a sense.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I felt like there was a teacher in me, but I knew that I didn't want to go the traditional path of, you know, going to school for it and lesson plans and all that kind of stuff. But now as a speaker and as an author, I really do get to teach. And I tell you, it's more fulfilling than anything I think I've ever done. I mean, I love singing. I love the stage, but there's something about sharing my experience and it resonating with someone. And then after a speech, a perfect stranger coming up and pointing out something that I said. Many times it's something that I just kind of came off the top of my head and how it resonated with them. And there's a spiritual connection between you and this stranger based on your experience. That's become even more powerful than the response I get from singing. Because it's just more, there's nothing showy about it. It's just authentic. It's person to person. It's spirit to spirit.
Let's talk about Broadway. You made your debut in Miss Saigon as John.
Well, I wasn't the first John. I wasn't. I was in the ensemble as first actor to understudy one of my musical theater heroes, Hinton Battle, who had won 2 Tony Awards already. He won his 3rd Tony Award playing John. And then when he actually won the Tony, he went from doing 8 shows a week to just doing 6. And they promoted me into playing the role twice a week, which was a dream come true. So for 6 shows a week, I was in the ensemble, and 2 shows a week, I was in Hinton's dressing room playing John. And he really nurtured me. He was a teacher for me. He let me ask him a million questions about the business. And, you know, he encouraged me. And then when he decided to leave after the first year, then they gave me the role full time, which was great because it gave me a chance to really see, a chance to really move up and not just be thrown into the fire. You know, I got a chance to prove myself as an ensemble member, prove myself as an understudy, prove myself as a person who did it a couple of times a week. And then all of that groomed me to play the role full time.
And to learn from him.
Oh, man, he was tremendously helpful because I was, you know, new to New York. It was my first Broadway show. I was thrilled to be there, but also still frightened to be in New York. And he really was relaxed. It'll be fine. He even helped me negotiate my contract. Once he found out that I would be taking over for him, he was like, make sure they give you this and make sure to ask for that. You may not get it, but still ask for it. I mean, he really was tremendously helpful to me. The whole entire Miss Saigon process was like a seemingly impossible dream come true. After Miss Saigon was Tommy. I did the Who's Tommy on Broadway, which was another incredible experience. I went in as a replacement and had never seen Tommy and was invited to... A friend of mine had a ticket to see the show, and I sat there and was completely blown away by the music, by the story, by the set, which was, you know, way ahead of its time. I mean, there were things that were done in Tommy that they're just now starting to do in the past 10 years, and this was back in, like, the 90s. It was just an incredible experience. And then 6 months later, I was cast in it, which was just like, whoa.
And then we get to Smokey Joe's Cafe, which also marks your West End debut. And then we come to Ragtime. So talk to me about that experience, first doing that out-of-town tryout and then going on tour with it and then seeing it through on Broadway.
When I was in junior high school, I saw the movie version of Ragtime. And up to that point, you know, I was loving, you know, having come out of my shell and performing, I was at this performing arts school, but still had doubts that I could pursue it as a career. And I remember walking out of the theater after seeing Ragtime, the movie, and going, I've got to do it. I mean, the way Howard Rollins, who played Cole House in the movie, his charisma and the way he played that role and how he made everybody in that audience feel, I thought, I've got to learn how to do that, to make people feel the way he's made me feel, and everybody in the audience. So to be cast as Cole House in the musical was a dream come true. I auditioned. I was flown out to LA to audition for what I thought would be the LA company, and it turns out that they wound up having me go to Toronto to replace Stokes instead. And that was disappointing to me because I really thought, wow, I get to be a part of the original company. And because at that point, I've been just replacing people. I never really originated a role. And I thought, well, I'm going to get a chance to work with, you know, the original creative team and really craft him the way I would do it. And then they wound up having me replace him in Toronto, which was incredible to work with Audra, work with Ian, and work with the original company. But it was still kind of a disappointment because by the time I got there, the creative team had gone on to L.A. To work on that production. So I kind of felt abandoned. And at one point, my management, you know, we kind of insisted to come and work with me. And they did. They changed the key to fit my voice more. They changed the choreography to fit me more as a dancer. So I did wind up having a better time at it. But what was really great was when I got to open the national tour, and it was me there with the creative team for 4 weeks, you know, really, really, really crafting and really having a chance to dive into the character and really make it my own. So again, sort of like with Miss Saigon, where I was starting the ensemble and then, you know, and understudying and taking over 2 times a week and then eventually taking over the role full time. It was great to sort of like be in school again with Ragtime, where I got to have this progression of really getting to dive into the character and really, really investigate who he was and what I could bring to it. So yeah, it was bittersweet at first, but it wound up being one of the most incredible educational experiences I've ever had. And then to come into Broadway with it and get to close it, and I got to be on the show poster, which was another, you know, dream come true for me, was it made all the hard work worth it.
While you're in Ragtime, you get wrongfully arrested and falsely accused of something.
Yeah, in the lobby of my building. I'll briefly go through what happened. I was on my way to the theater. It was a Friday, beautiful day. I was going to go to the gym and then stop at the bank to cash my checks because we paid the night before, and then go to the theater and get ready for a weekend of shows. And I'm walking through my lobby, and I just noticed 2 guys in my lobby on their cell phones. And the first thing I thought was they have cell phone reception. Nobody seems to have cell phone reception down in the lobby. And then as I get closer to the door, I see what looks like paramedics. I lived in a beautiful historic landmark building in Harlem. Duke Ellington lived in my building. I lived in an apartment that Duke Ellington once lived in. Beautiful. So people have been living there for decades. And I thought, oh my God, you know, maybe somebody, one of the elderly in the building is in need of paramedics. So I speed up to open the door, and I get close and I realize that it's cops. And the first one is a female, right? Open the door, go, good afternoon. Next thing you know, I'm pushed up against the wall, told to take off my backpack, put my hands behind my back, get on my knees, and I'm handcuffed. And I'm told they got a call about light-skinned Hispanics who were dealing drugs. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not light-skinned. I'm not Hispanic. I'm not 21, because I think they said 18 to 21 or something like that. So I'm like, okay, it must be the 2 guys in the lobby who I'd never seen before. And, you know, they couldn't get into the lobby because we're in the vestibule at this point. So I get up off my knees, give them my keys to get into the lobby, thinking, okay, they're going to go. They're going to get who they want. They're going to go, thank you, sorry, sir, unhandcuff me, and this will be an interesting story to tell when I get to work. They go get the guys. They're in there questioning them for a while, and then they wind up bringing them out through the vestibule, and they take me along with them to the precinct, where I'm kept for 6 hours. I am thrown in jail. I am strip searched. I'm brought in and out for questioning. And after 6 hours, and, you know, caused me to miss my performance that evening, they say, we're sorry, you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I said, I do not accept your apology. I was where I live. I let you in to where I live to do your job. I do not accept your apology. May I leave? And I left, and it was kind of surreal. And the papers got a hold of it. You know, all this, you know, leading up to the 11 o'clock news that night, you know, Broadway stars arrested on drug charges. And I thought, are you kidding me? Am I that guy? Are they going to try to make me like, like, what is going on? And when the news came on, they finally were like, you know, it was a mistaken arrest, this and that. And the next day is on the kind of page 2 of most of a lot of the papers. And I think one of the only reasons why it wasn't on the cover was because it was the same evening that JFK Jr.'s plane went down. And papers got a hold of it, you know, and they wanted interviews, and I would give interviews. And I was being represented by the NCLU, Civil Liberties Union, and the papers kind of sensationalized it because we had to come up with a number to sue the NYPD for, and I didn't want to do a million because it seemed pretentious. So we came up with 750, knowing that you're not going to get that. It's just a number. But people were acting as if I had already won that. So the articles were getting, you know, it was just really absurd. You know, here this like serious thing happened to me, this thing that happens to many Black men. And people are thinking about, you know, money. So I got a call from The Nation magazine about an interview. I'd never heard of The Nation. And I said, you know, I'm done with doing interviews. I said, let me write an article about what happened. And they said, you know, have you ever written anything? I said, no, but let me try. So I wrote an article, sent to them. They liked it, made some edits, asked me for a picture. And next thing I know, they're like, well, we're putting you on the cover.
In the Nation article, you say your perception of everything that you had learned as a young man was changed forever.
Yeah, really. It was, I mean, I left my building so excited about the weekend. You know, it's Friday, you know, it's paid the night before. I get to, you know, go to the gym and get ready to do my five show, to do this incredible role. And, you know, and then to be swept away into the surreal world of like 6 hours of like, why am I here? Like, I don't get the description. Like, why haven't they just apologized? Why are they keeping me? And then realizing, oh, wow, this is what racial profiling is. This is what using your powers not for good. This is what this is like. This is what an abuse of power looks like. And I'm the victim of it. So I did. I felt like I matured. I walked home from that precinct going, wow, I am not the same version of myself that I was before. My eyes have been opened. And it was really difficult emotionally for a while, because once you've had an experience like that, it changes your perception of everything. And when I went back to the show, I mean, my whole house was on fire, because this is what happened to this character almost 100 years before. And it's like, whoa, it's like art imitating life in reverse. So yeah, I was grateful that, you know, that I am an actor and a creative person. I got to really use all that pain, all that realism, and bring it to the role and really, really bring it home. It was a tremendous honor. It was difficult. But you don't really know how strong you are until you're tested in those kind of ways. And it made me fearless about a lot of things. Things I was afraid of before. When you have an experience like that, that could go either way. It's like, whoa. Especially the cases that we see now, it's like, you know, it gives you a different kind of strength and different kind of wisdom. And also knowing that, you know, it happened to me for a reason, you know, and thank God I was in a position to talk about it. Thank God I was in the show. Thank God I was on Broadway and had the kind of visibility that I had to really speak about it. Because there are many people that happened to who don't have the voice that I had at that time. They don't have the platform that I had at that time. So all of that wound up being a blessing and what felt like divine order.
After Ragtime, you're part of not one, but two big Broadway shows. The Color Purple is Mr. and The Lion King is Mufasa. And for a while, you were in them both at the same time.
Yeah, which was like very cool. Yeah, I was playing Mufasa in the evenings and rehearsing the role of Mr. in the afternoons, which was just incredible to play these two opposing characters and to really tap into my own experience and to be reminded that, you know, wow, I'm not, because Mufasa is so close to who I am, but to go, yeah, I get to really act. I get to really tap into that pain, into that, because Mr. is really hurt. I mean, Mr. comes across as mean, but for me, my portrayal of him was him masking his hurt and not being able to deal with it. So he lashed out at anybody he came in contact with and definitely, you know, didn't use his powers for good. It was great to dive into that. And in doing that, in doing the research for Mr., I've seen the movie like most people, but had never read the book. And that's what really, really told me everything I needed to know about Mr., you know, that he was hurt and that he was jealous of his son because his son was born a generation later. He got to exercise the freedoms of men coming out of slavery. And Mr. is part of that generation just after slavery, where it's like, you know, you better be happy. Your father gave you this land and this has to be it. But he didn't want that. He wanted Harpo's life. And that for me, even with Celie, he was jealous of Celie's resilience. No matter what he did to her, she would always bounce back, no matter what. And it wasn't until he made peace with himself and forgave himself that he was able to really expand and become unstuck and really mature. That was huge for me as an actor, and huge for me in healing my relationship with my father, who, you know, suffered from alcoholism. It gave me compassion for him in that, you know, men, black men of his generation, not that far removed from slavery, had so few outlets for really expressing their pain and their hurt. So yeah, it just kind of opened my eyes to, it deepened my level of compassion.
Well, and in speaking to you, one thing that kind of I'm seeing as the through line to all these characters that we've talked about is you have really not only dove into the role as an actor, but it almost seems like these characters have also taught you lessons as a man, as a person, that you've learned from them.
Absolutely. Each of my shows, because I have my show posters in my office on my wall, and they're my diplomas, they're my degrees, because I learned so much about myself and the arts and all those things from each one of those shows. So yeah, they each one has been like being in school and getting that degree in many different things. And that's one of the great things about being an artist. I mean, being an artist is challenging because it is a very solitary path, but there's so much that we get to experience, so much that we get to learn about ourselves, if we're open to it.
Can't not talk about The Lion King. What did you learn from Mufasa? What did Mufasa teach you?
The importance of words. You know, one of the challenging things about playing Mufasa at first was like, he has so little to do. He's got like 5 lines the entire show. I mean, he doesn't have a lot to say. But as I got to mature in the role, it was really about choosing your words carefully. So that's what I learned about the art of stillness, the art of simplicity, the art of meaning what you say, the art of exercising quiet authority. Those are things I learned.
Knowing what you know now and building this life and career for yourself,
mm-hmm.
What would you say to that painfully shy, insecure little boy in church? What would you say to him?
I would say it's okay to be different. It's okay to be so different than everybody around you, everybody in your family, everybody in your neighborhood, everybody at school. Who you are is enough. It's okay to keep doing what feels like going against the grain, because there is a spectacular life waiting for you, and it will all make sense. That's what I would say to him. That's what I do say to him, because, you know, certain things come up. You know, I mean, we are different versions of who we've already been, or who we once were, right? And there are certain things that come up, and I go, it's okay, little Allison. It's okay. I got this. You're good.
2 years ago, White published a beautiful book called My Pride, Mastering Life's Daily Performance. In it, he draws from his own life experience and career and the rich lore of The Lion King to illustrate what daily performance really means on stage and off. RD on Stage is giving away an autographed copy of White's book, as well as an autographed copy of his CD, Disney My Way, to one of our lucky listeners. So check out our social media pages at RDU on Stage to find out more on how you can enter this drawing. I'm also putting a link to White's webpage, as well as to the Nation article he and I talked about, in the episode notes. On a side note, the Playmakers production of Ragtime, starring Hamilton's Fergie Philippe as Cole House, opens November 23rd in Chapel Hill. Visit playmakersrep.org for more information on that production. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to this podcast, follow us on social media, become a patron of this program, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next week, I'll see you at the theater.